All right, folks, Adidas. Adidas is pushing the boundaries once again in golf footwear. And if you've been counting, I haven't been counting. It's a lot of times. But they're doing it again, so whatever many times it's been, it's at one. So you need to check this out. It's called the Code Chaos, all capitals. The footwear team let me know that this shoe is meant to break down traditional stereotypes and make a statement that there doesn't have to be one look for the sport when it comes to golf footwear. It's athletic and bold from a style standpoint, but this shoe is seriously packed with technology. It's spikeless, but beyond just being tested with guys like DJ and Xander, they did heat map studies. Heat map. That means they know where you are right now. They literally know. And watch, I'm telling you, you're going to get an ad for Adidas footwear in your feed. I'm telling you, and it's not me. I don't know if it's them. It's probably Xander, not DJ. Xander's got an X in his name, so he's a little more sinister. Even though I would probably feel more likely that DJ would really, he could do some damage with the club to my face. So to see how players shift their weight, they use this heat mapping technology to see where they shift their weight, but also where you are physically at this current moment throughout the swing. So anyway, with all that info, they created a new traction system called Twist Grip. Twist Grip. That's spelled the way it sounds. Anyway, so the players get the grip they need exactly where they need it, and this is an ad lib, and when they need it. I just added that. It's waterproof. Waterproof is key. Let's get honest, folks. If you want a waterproof shoe, unless you live in the desert, you can wear sandals or moccasins. But for everybody else, you need the waterproof shoe. So hit up the Code Chaos. It's waterproof, lightweight, and obviously has the boost cushioning, which we all love. There's even a high-top BOA version, which I'm not sure I'm man enough to rock, but John Rahm is. But he's very, very good at golf. We can all agree. These things are next level, so get yourself a pair. Head over to adidas.com/codechaos, spelled the way it sounds. Although the C-H in chaos sounds more like a K, so it's C-O-D-E-C-H-A-O-S. And shop the styles and follow Adidas Golf on Instagram and Twitter for all the latest news from Les Trois Stripes. That's three stripes, folks. All right, one more ad read. I'll probably do another one after this. Jones Sports Go, folks. If you want the bag that I rock, it's the Jones Sports Bag. They got the Player Series. They got the original. What's the other models they got? The stand bags? We're pulling it up in the studio, folks. But here's the thing. Jones, if you haven't seen the video on YouTube yet, please check it out. We went up there, visited with them. We designed a lot of cool stuff. We're going to be designing more stuff. We have two bags on the Random Golf Club site that have the Random Golf Club script on it. The Utility Trooper is the info I'm getting of the name of the other bag that I like. It's got the stand. It's got the stand bag. I mostly rock the original, which is based on a design from the 70s. Was his name Jones? His name was Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones and me. Now, that guy got in a lot of trouble for some, what's that? Taxi cabs. But the guy who sang the song, Mr. Jones, he's gotten in a lot of trouble. Don't want to talk about him. But Mr. Jones, not that the song is written about, was a taxi driver in New York. He made a golf bag out of the upholstery in his taxi. And that's where Jones has come from. So they're obviously the comfortable shoulder strap on the original series is what I love. Got a lot of cargo space, and you got three pockets to hold all your clubs. And you look basically like a badass. If you don't have a significant other at the start of the round, you will have one at the end. Am I right? Watch out. It's you know, that's the studio here says, get a Jones bag. I'm not going to say get laid, but basically that's what's going to happen. I mean, I didn't say it. You said it. You heard it. I didn't say it. Jones Sports Go, everybody. Love them. TaylorMade, folks. I got to tell you, the first golf clubs that ever went in my little old hands were TaylorMade Burner Oversize. They had some crusty old grips that I redid myself at risk of my own fingertips with the razor, and I got high because I don't know if you've ever regripped your clubs, but you become an inhalant addict because you're putting like really noxious stuff. Don't grip your own clubs unless you really want to. Anyway, mad respect. Give me a fist bump whenever I see you. I grip my own clubs. I put the grips on them myself. I saved. How much did you save? I mean, you could save money. You save money because I think you put them on. It's like $20 each, and you buy the grips yourself. It's like $8. By the way, regripping 14 clubs. I mean, that's like a lot. Go buy TaylorMade's instead. They come with grips. My favorite TaylorMade edition now, obviously the Sim Max I'm playing, is a monster club. One of the many things Tiger Woods have and I in common is playing the sim, but also I kind of love the wedges, the raw-faced wedges, MG. I both love the high toe in matte black. I also have a matte black shaft. I know you didn't ask, but I went ahead and told you. Anyway, TaylorMade, my favorite thing about TaylorMade beyond the incredibly performing equipment is the people that make this company up. The band of brothers down here, the band of sisters, the family in Carlsbad really, really gets behind what we do, and that means it's important for you to get behind what they do. So go support TaylorMade, everybody, and hit them straight, or just don't. Just hit them with TaylorMade's, though. Just get some. Just stop messing around with all the others. Hit them straight with TaylorMade, but just hit TaylorMade at least. I mean, if you're not, I mean, just go. I mean, what are you doing? Just pause the pod. Go on TaylorMade. What's their website? They don't even need a website. Just go find TaylorMade ASAP. There should be, what? What I play? I play the, okay, studio is asking me to play. I play the P760s, 4 through pitch. Then I've got the milled grind raw face 50, 54, and 58. And then I rock. I'm in between the Gapper and the Sim Hybrid right now. I play the 2 Gapper. I've got a steel shafted 6.5 Project X in that one, as with all the irons. And then on the driver, I have the Sim Max with a 9 degree. I'm still working on getting my numbers on that. I don't really know. I got the 10.5 and the 9. We're going to do a little experimentation. Maybe, honestly, you know what? Whatever one I don't use, how about it's yours? How about that? I don't know how we're going to manage this. Head over to the Instagram account. Get ready for the old giveaway of the driver that I can't hit. Anyway, TaylorMade's the family, folks. You know, before we get into a lot of things, it just occurred to me that people probably recognize you from your voice. They probably hear you and they say, that's your Dottie Pepper.
Much more than sight.
What does that interaction look like?
I hate my voice, so I'm not sure.
You do not.
I do.
You have a great voice.
I think, every time I hear myself on radio, I just think it's, ugh.
You wouldn't have gotten the job that you have if, objectively speaking, you didn't have a pleasing voice.
Yeah, I mean, you learn how to project and you learn how to use it as an instrument.
Do you want to take the headphones off then?
No, I'm good. No, this actually makes it sound a little better to me.
It's a good quality headphones.
Yeah, it's good.
So you don't like the sound of your own voice?
No. I often turn down radio earlier when I was playing because I just thought I sounded terrible.
Like during interviews and stuff? Interesting. Mm-hmm. But when people come up to you and they say, I know your voice, what do they usually say to you?
It's the voice that puts them to sleep on Sunday afternoon on the couch. Truly. I've had people say to my husband, is it okay that I like falling asleep to the sound of your wife's voice on Sunday afternoon watching golf? I guess that's all right.
What does, I'm sure that David's also watching.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Critiquing, watching, applauding, all of the above. So he's my filter.
Right. Yeah. I'm curious to know about that. So you met David, third husband. I'm curious to know, is it, you guys, obviously he's a historian, he's involved in golf deeply. I don't know what your other relationships in your life have been like, but I'm curious to know, to what extent does golf play the sort of pivotal, sort of convening theme in your relationship?
It's there. It's work. But we do a really good job of setting it aside as well. If you go into our house, you'll see zero golf memorabilia except in our two offices.
Interesting.
It is very compartmentalized.
Is that, and I'm learning my new career is golf, that on some level, you know, golf started out as, you know, a game for me, is fun, is leisure activity, and now it's pretty much exclusively work.
Yeah.
And so it's sad to think that going on a golf trip is necessary for me as a person and a golfer, but it's also strange and sort of feels a little bit like work every once in a while.
Sure, and it's the same for us. Golf was my passion that turned into my work. Passion turned into education, turned into work, and now it's a continuing education, and I think that's kind of his trajectory as well, now that I kind of stop and think about it. But things that we do at home, we set golf aside. We have to. We both enjoy canoeing. We both like being outside. We both are good skiers. I mean, we like doing the other things that golf really allows us to do.
Yeah, I'm beginning to see that I need a new hobby.
Yeah.
So what would you, can you recommend any that are easy? You guys live in, a nice suburban or rural maybe.
We're border. I mean, we live in the city limits, but it gets rural quickly. Yes.
Is it upstate New York or is
upstate
it central? Okay. Upstate.
No, definitely upstate. Eastern New York, I guess, if you wanted to be
on the
super
Hudson?
Technical. We're very close to the Hudson. We're within an hour of the Vermont border. So we are way east.
That sounds ideal. Living in LA, what should I pick up as a hobby that's not just let's go play golf, let's watch golf?
You have amazing hiking so close here.
I kind of hate hiking, and part of it is because the LA thing to do is to go for a hike.
Okay, so what is the non-LA thing to do? Because that's what she should probably do.
Yeah, I guess. What would it be? It'd be like to play golf?
Yeah, right. Sit in traffic?
Yeah. Well, I'll need to unpack this a little bit on my own, but I'm realizing that I need to sort of...
You need to... It's a balance.
So that I'm refreshed when, like you, when you go to a golf tournament and you have to, call the golf for... How long is it? 5 hours?
It can be 5 hours, yes. I mean, we did a 5-hour show opening on Saturday at San Diego because of weather delays.
Right.
You're going to play to the finish. It's going to be on somewhere. It's not just because you have a 3-hour network window. You're going to finish that day, even if Mother Nature finishes it for you. You're going to finish it dark.
What do you do to prepare for that? I mean, it seems, I think very few people on planet Earth have the experience of speaking into a microphone with no buffer on live television. It scared me. I did it once or twice maybe, and it was super scary until the red light went on, and then you're just in it.
You talk about golf, as you know, through a speedy filter.
Speedy filter. What is that?
Kind of hear yourself say what you intrinsically know, that you know about golf, because that's what you're really out there talking as someone who knows the game of golf. But to run it through today's silly PC filters, because you are trying to keep your job.
Yeah, you can't. Let's talk about that for a second. That's changed a lot of what we can say. And obviously, the way we talk to our friends at dinner is different than the way you talk even right now, probably.
Or the way I talk to myself.
Whoa.
Completely different than what I would, that would be permissible to go over the air.
I'm curious to know Dottie's internal dialogue. What does it sound like?
Sometimes it's not real positive. There's a lot of what the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'd imagine as a professional athlete, that sort of comes with the territory.
Of course.
You have to be critical.
If you're not critical, you're not going to get better. And I think that goes as you're looking back at shows. I watch a lot of our shows again, and I'm very critical of myself in the effort to get better.
What do you see typically that you're sort of saying, I don't want to do that anymore?
I think I can continue to be more economical with words, a better choice of words that paint a picture just a little sharper.
Right.
And that's what I'm always trying to do. And this came back from when I first started doing this in 2004 with Mike Tirico. He always goes back and watches his own shows. And think about the number of shows and the variety of shows he does. Everything from the NFL to studio to golf to Olympics to you name it, Mike Tirico has done it and continues to do it today on radio even with Westwood.
Right.
So if he's spending that time to go back over all of his shows, I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, you it's mandatory to review.
It really is.
I don't like doing that, especially with the podcast, because when I started out, I really didn't know anything about it.
Well, the format is also much looser with a podcast.
Sure, but I can't do it. I go back and listen, and I cringe.
See? This is why I didn't do radio, because I cringed at the sound of my voice.
No, it's not the sound of my voice.
I've gotten
comfortable with that. It's what I'm saying or how I'm saying it, or, one of the things that I really saw myself doing and that I've heard other podcasters do is interrupting the guest.
You don't like that?
Hate it.
Oh, okay.
Why are they on?
Fair enough.
I get that you sometimes want to steer it to a certain direction,
sure,
or you have an idea, but it would infuriate me. And actually, some people I've seen, I don't know where or how, but some people say, oh, you know, he's stop you know, cutting the guest off or whatever. And so I've tried to, that's been the biggest thing I've tried to change is just stop talking.
But you wouldn't have known that unless you listened a little bit to your own work.
True.
Yeah. So that's, I think, where I'm getting at. We don't realize things sometimes because we're in the heat of the moment and we're always thinking ahead. What's next? Whether, so if we have that time to really put it under a little bit of a microscope, a little bit of a filter, I think we'd get better.
Do you ever, especially at some of the premiere events that you work at, do you ever go in thinking, oh, I'd like to, I just observed this and I'd like to somehow work that into what I'm talking about? And you must. A lot of what you're talking about is technical, but you have a very creative job.
Yes. And I think you come in with a pretty large volume of preparation and you use maybe 10% of it. So things that you think the day may turn out to be, I mean, somebody could open double-double and you have all of this information on somebody and you've spoken to their caddy, you've spoken to their agent, you've spoken to their mom and dad, and none of it ever sees air. That happens, and it doesn't happen infrequently. So, yeah, you have a preconceived idea of what the day is going to look like and what the conversations might be, and by the time we get on the air, it's all been shot to hell, gone.
That's just happens.
That's live television.
You've worked for every broadcast company that does golf.
I have, and they fit interesting different places I was in my life, because I was, you know, really trying to cut my teeth. Golf Channel early on, 2004, and NBC was primarily my focus was women's golf. They had the USGA package, so the US Women's Open was huge, not only for me but for the company. Put a lot of resources into it. Tommy Roy, the producer, huge women's golf fan, and did some studio Golf Channel, but I was living in Florida, and I was just getting into the business, and it was okay to do 30 weeks a year.
Right.
And some of it was just going up and down on the Florida Turnpike. I'm 2 hours from the studio. I don't have to be living in Orlando. I was very happy living in Jupiter. Decide in 2000, end of 2008, that I really wanted to move back home to upstate New York, continue to do NBC, but having Golf Channel on top of it, and the way things had changed at Comcast and Golf Channel and kind of looking forward, it was no longer a great fit. I wanted a personal balance instead of just work all the time and coming home to a dog who was heartbroken rather than having a balanced life. So Golf Channel goes away in 2009. Comcast buys NBC.
There you go.
So and I'm right back. And we're back.
Back to Dottie.
So as that evolved going into 2012, it looked like, again, it was going to be more and more time away. Harder place to travel from at home, but I'm very happy at home. So I decided to walk away and had an opportunity to serve on the PGA board, kind of refine my look on golf from an administrative standpoint, from a Grow the Game standpoint, from a lot of different places. And ESPN came along with the perfect package because they just had the USGA and they had the Open Championships. So it was 8 weeks of work. It was phenomenal. And I could still do it with serving on the board at the PGA, calling remotely to board meetings and do those sort of requirements. And then as that landscape changed, ESPN was good enough to let me take up the opportunity that CBS came with me. So it's all evolved as my life has evolved, and I've been really fortunate.
I think one of the most interesting things about all that is, well, there's two things I find. Let's first talk about the 2 years with the serving on the PGA.
Three.
And focusing on advancing junior golf. That was obviously... What was the genesis of that? Was that you saying I need to work on something that's happening in the landscape of golf worldwide right now, or did they find you and say you can help us?
Ted Bishop found me. I was in a position where I think at some point you need to leave things maybe a little bit better than you found them, and that was my opportunity to do that. Junior golf was a huge thing. Women's golf opportunities were, but I wouldn't have been in the position I was without my PGA professional, no doubt.
When you got into
when
golf?
When I got into golf.
At what age?
I started playing the summer I was 7, 8 years old, but I met him in my early teens and changed the direction of how I looked at the game, opportunities that I had, my belief in the fundamentals of the game that haven't changed, and the way he was a steward of the game for so many people, whether they were 55-year-old businessmen or just kids coming up. He imparted so much good about the game in such a great way that it was my opportunity that, okay, you know, financially I'm okay. I don't need to work right now, and let's do something a little different. Let's I looked at buying a business at home. I mean, I was ready to just kick this to the curb, this whole television, travel, all of that. And like I said, ESPN came calling at just the right time with just the amount of work. But I would have been pretty happy just being a little Saratogian and owning the flower shop and doing all that. We explored all of it.
A flower shop.
Mm-hmm.
What would you call the flower shop? Did you have a name?
Well, it is. It would have been buying a business that's there now. It's the Posey Peddler. There you go.
I'm curious to know more about the pro that you knew as a youngster. What was
his name? Was George Pulver. He was a founding member of the Northeastern New York PGA section. Played, qualified for a number of PGA championships. Very, very nice player and in his own right. And family work took precedent, as a lot of PGA professionals who qualified for the championship at that time didn't play because they couldn't afford to.
Right.
His daughter played college golf at a very, very early stage in women's collegiate golf. She's now in her early 80s, still very active from a media standpoint. She ran HR for Gannett. I mean, just his son played baseball with my dad. I mean, it was a Saratoga family, but he was Scottish background that was just golf at its core. And built clubs, built golf courses, was an agronomist, did all of it. So I had the great luck of having all of that. And every lesson he gave me, there was a typed letter left in my parents' mailbox, summarizing, looking forward, and usually leaving me with a book to read.
Wow.
Very thorough.
Much more than just a simple swing coach.
Way more.
Yeah, it's too bad that I feel like the landscape for newcomers to the game and their relationship to the professionals, the PGA professionals that they interact with, it's hard. I feel like it's harder and harder, and maybe it's because I'm a city kid, right? New York and LA. It's harder to develop that relationship, it seems like.
It seems like it's a little easier relationship to develop if there's a green grass element to it.
Yeah.
Although George Gankus has done a hell of a job.
Off mats, yeah.
Off mats. I applaud him, man. He's making golf cool for a lot of people.
Right.
Way cool.
What what was the biggest challenge that you were dealing with on the PGA working with them?
I think it's a continuing battle, and the word revenue just drives me crazy.
Why?
Because it's changed the way people look at golf professionals and the way they look at their memberships. The minute revenue came into the vocabulary, I think some of the passion of the PGA professional was somehow changed to looking at the almighty dollar. Where if we look at the bigger scope of making the game healthier, that all takes care of itself.
When did revenue become? Because ultimately, when you said revenue, I was kind of thinking I agree, but also, Who's getting that revenue?
Like, right.
Who is that?
Yeah, who is it? Where does it go?
Yeah.
And how much of it is actually getting back to the PGA professional? That is why I think there's angst with PGA professionals and national, because they don't feel like national is doing a good enough job at what they need to do for their jobs rather than running it as a big organization. And I do think that Seth Waugh is trying to address that. Let's get more to the PGA professional and what they need to do their jobs better. Because if they do better, the whole game does better.
Yeah, I mean, because it's like golf as a sport is not a nonprofit.
No.
But it has a lot of very complicated logistical elements to it that it has to kind of burden to make money or to even stay in business.
You have to spend money to make money at golf. You have to. It's not, golf courses just don't stay playable.
Yeah.
You have to spend money. Facilities take money to run. But I think golf also changed when the GM became a big part of clubs. And
tell me about that. I don't know about that.
Instead of just your golf professional being the guy that's, or woman that's in there running the operation, they're now answering to somebody who's looking at revenue.
We're a business.
We're a business.
Yeah.
Where I believe if you nurture it a little more organically, the business takes care of itself instead of forcing it from top down.
From my perspective, I've heard some anecdotal things about this and whatever, but it seems like Tiger happened.
Yep.
Everyone started making a lot of money. Everything was really busy in golf. And then all of a sudden, it was like we became, as a community, goal-oriented, dollar-oriented. And then all of a sudden, you know, golf just became out of reach for a lot of people.
But what drove it? Where did people think they were going to make their money? Real estate.
Right.
So we overbuilt golf courses thinking that Tiger was going to deliver everything. He was going to deliver cool golf. He was going to deliver housing developments. He was going to deliver infrastructure. He was going to do all of this when it was just greedy.
Right.
To think that, oh, developers are going to make a ton of money.
Yeah, I mean, on some level, it's like you don't see basketball courts every corner.
Correct.
You don't see baseball diamonds everywhere.
Correct. And we built bigger and bigger golf courses that took more and more money to keep up.
Yeah, and sort of even still with other sports, with the exception of maybe hockey, that they don't cost much as a user, so there's not much revenue to be made playing Little League.
Exactly.
But now it's, oh, well, we've got this plot of land on the lake, and there's a hole that you can see. That's complex.
It's very complex. It gets back to the root of why are we doing this? And I don't think people ask that question. And then we get back to that revenue word.
Well, why are we doing this is a very tough question to ask. And I've tried to actually stop with myself.
But if people had asked, why are we building this? Why are we really building this golf course?
Uh-huh.
We're building it to sell real estate.
To make money.
Make money.
Yeah, that's tough.
How do we sustain that golf? Because the golf was what brought people into it to begin with.
Right.
So now we have these fights going on where people have all this money invested in their homes and their home sites.
And the course closes.
Correct.
Ouch.
That's a big ouch.
Happened almost to my parents.
Yeah. It's happened to a lot of people.
What does it, can it, will it ever change? Will it ever revert? Is that what needs to happen?
I think this wave of simple golf, a lot of the things that you've been talking about, helps reverse that. People understand it doesn't have to be flashy. It doesn't have to be gilded. It doesn't have to be this perfect green. It has to be rewarding golf. And I'm just sensing that simpler golf is starting to really take hold. 9-hole experience, the using the golf course for other things like where we are in upstate New York, it's open all year long to go cross-country skiing, snowshoeing. They flood the back for skating. They use their club for more than just golf.
Right. It seems like that's going to be hard to do. There's no rules that you can enforce that could say, okay, you know, in order for golf to survive in a brilliant future, this mm-hmm. is what we need to do. It seems like it's just kind of, you know, if there's 30,000 courses, it's like there's 30,000 people that aren't really voting for the best thing for the game.
Right. And I think, too, everybody had their hair on fire about golf is going to go away. We're writing the epitaph now. But if you look at golf as maybe in the restaurant industry, if 4 restaurants closed in this neighborhood in Santa Monica, you wouldn't say the restaurant business is in trouble.
Right, right.
Maybe it was a bad business model.
Yeah.
So I think we have to look a little closer to about is it a sustainable business model that we've set this golf course and golf course community on a path to?
Right.
Have we set ourselves up for failure?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's it's a hard question. And on some level, I do feel like I can do something. But mm-hmm. even in my position, it does feel on some level. Well, the interesting experience for me is I'm in L.A. very not often. I'm here now.
You're on an airplane.
Yeah, primarily an airplane. Yes. There's no golf courses on planes. No. Yeah. I come home to LA, and when I, as a public golfer, I want to go play, and it's actually pretty challenging to find a good course that is, and I don't even, I'm okay to pay any mm-hmm. price. It doesn't yep. really matter, but it's sort of, it's a challenge. Even Rustic Canyon.
Access.
Cannot get on. Yeah. Literally, first tee time we have is 1:30. Sunsets at 5, okay. You know, wherever. So it's like an hour and 20-minute drive usually, which, yep. yeah, I mean, it's a specific problem perhaps. What have you seen as you travel around American cities? Who do you think has the public golf solution? Have you seen it? Have you?
I think there are pockets that get it right. Fortunate where we live, city of 28,000 people, we have, well, city limits, we have 54 holes
okay.
within our city limit. 27 are a state-run public facility. And I think while they do a good job, it's underutilized because they have a short course, a par 29. And so there's 7 par 3s and 2 par 4s. Walkable from downtown if you wanted to. And 18 holes of a championship course. What are we doing to make those incubators?
Right.
I think...
Get people into golf.
Get people into golf. Get them started. Keep them. Because where those facilities excel are the kids, getting them on the golf course, being there for junior programming, and also for senior golf.
Right.
Because it's still manageable.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Augusta, a couple of your dog, and a couple other things. Be right back. All right. I'm going to catch me now. We got... give me a second, all right? I'm about to do an ad read for Vice Golf. I don't even have a read, so this is an ad lib. This is an ad libbed read. Anyway, Vice Golf, you all know I love the brand. They make a great golf ball, and there are things that I would tell you in person about the golf ball that I can't tell you in a public forum. But basically, the golf ball is amazing. Technically speaking, on test, it performs as good or better than what we call, quote, the best golf ball on tour. Now, the Vice Golf Ball also has one cool thing, which is that it's cool. Obviously, the scripting is really sweet. But beyond that, it has another cool thing. I'm going to keep pulling cool things out of this ball. The second cool thing is that you can't get it in a pro shop. So go online, go to vicegolf.com, and get your slick balls. They've got all different types. They've got the tour, they've got the drive, they've got the pro, they've got the pro plus. They've got different colors, and you can also personalize less than, you can personalize, I don't know what number you can personalize, but you can personalize them. Whereas other brands don't let you personalize them except for once a year. So check out vicegolf.com. Get yourself some smooth and cool balls for the course, that is. Anyway, y'all, see you in the showers until the next ad read. Precision Pro, folks. I'm going to do an ad-libbed Precision Pro read. Here's the thing about Precision Pro. They're made by some great guys in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's got great design. And coming out soon, you're going to get a very special colorway of the NX9 Pro with slope. Is that right? That's it. I got a thumbs up in the studio here that's the exact rangefinder. Not only do you get free battery replacement for life, but you get slope and you get laser. I mean, it is a laser. Laser sharp accuracy. And you get, I don't know, you just get to be part of something cool that I'm down with. So Precision Pro is great. Obviously, the family there in Cincinnati makes them good. We did an RGC there. If you haven't seen it, check out the video on the YouTube channel. We gave everybody a rangefinder. But stay tuned. Coming around April, we're going to be releasing a random golf club version of this rangefinder. It is the most beautiful rangefinder I've ever seen on planet Earth. And I, as you know, I haven't traveled any other planets yet. I've done a lot of countries and states and towns, continents, hemispheres. But I've never left the planet. And I was just talking to someone who said that that's on their bucket list. It's not on mine. I don't share that. But on this planet, the Random Golf Club rangefinder will literally blow your mind, but it won't blow your wallet. The rangefinder for everyone, people. Enjoy it. All right. We are back. We have actually changed locations. We're in your traveling home here, this hotel room in Los Angeles. We were interrupted by a lovely family wanting to play pool. So we've switched into the business center here. It's very quiet. Better sound. What sticks out to you when you think about Augusta?
Wow. I think it's some of the things that people don't know or don't realize, that it's just a winter club. It's not open during the summer. It's not overseeded. It's not green all year long. That's beautiful rye overseed that makes it pop the way it does. And some of the things people don't realize about the show, that there's no blimp.
Interesting.
There's no blimp. It's very quiet out there. So you don't hear the noise of the Goodyear blimp. It's extremely quiet. The other thing, there are no walkers. Everyone is... So my normal job is not my normal job. I'm sitting in a tower, and there are no on-course reporters. So those are the two biggest differences from week-to-week coverage, or even other major championships. There's nobody on the ground.
You normally have the belt with the wire and the mic and the headphones.
The extra 8 pounds, yes, in this, of course.
And you're kind of walking up and down the hole or holes. In this case, you're stationed.
You're stationed. The other thing, you can't walk in the fairways during a practice round. You're out there with the patrons doing your homework from outside. But what you can do, and I make sure I do every day, this goes back to Clifford Roberts and Bob Jones. They wanted the announcers that were calling their golf tournament to know what the greens did, so you go out and putt every morning.
They give you...
Yeah, I take my putter with me. I take 3 balls, and I've been out at 13 every year I've been assigned there. Early in the morning, it's just, you got to pinch yourself.
So they allow the gates open at 8 o'clock?
Whatever they determine.
And you're there alone, isolated on 13, or are fans in yet?
No, but they've just started to filter in by the time I get there. So there's a few people that are in the observation stand to the right.
Right.
Which is more over by really
14T.
14T. Exactly.
And where are you? You're...
High right.
High right. So
up
you're sort
the trees,
of behind
really.
The... Oh, you're...
Back right of 13.
Okay.
Sits up high.
And you hang out there all day.
This little green... desk with plexiglass, and it's me, my spotter, and the cameraman.
Do people bring food to you during the
no.
day? Do they
bring it yourself?
You go out. Oh, you bring
yeah,
you bring
you
up
just,
lunch.
Yeah, if you want snacks, bring them yourself.
Okay,
there's a cooler up there.
Because it would be tough if you went to the snack shack. That would be. That
it's
would
close
be,
though.
It's very close.
It's very close.
It's right there.
It is.
It's such a special place for to visit every year. It must be for you.
It is, but this past year. I woke up and I looked at David and I said, did that really happen yesterday? Tiger won the Masters. And he won it in the middle of the afternoon before the weather turned. So we actually got to go back to the house and watch the re-air. That was bizarre. It was wonderfully bizarre.
What struck out to you the most from the back nine that Sunday when Tiger won the Masters?
The change of... trajectory with one golf swing, and it wasn't his.
It was Koepka
at 12.
Right.
Changed it all.
Koepka was in the group before him?
No, they were...
It was a three?
Yeah, they played...
Molinari, Koepka, they were... Oh,
no,
I see.
No, Tony Finau.
Finau, right.
Finau. Koepka, Molinari, it was one... I wouldn't even say one hole or one swing, it was that hole.
Yeah.
And then it was coming to me. And the whole dynamic of the tournament had changed.
So you have a TV.
I have a TV. I have a scoring monitor.
Right. So you have basically what they see in the media
program.
Center. You have one monitor is what's playing on TV, mm-hmm. and the other is just the leaderboard as it changes.
Leaderboard as it changes on hot rounds of the day.
Hot round. Oh, okay. People.
So you know who's, yeah, lower right on that monitor is who the best rounds on the course.
Right. What do you see when you look at 13? It could be one of the most interesting holes in all of golf that's not really that wild in its construction.
Partly because it was just there. They did very little to construct that hole. When they were out, McKenzie was out there walking. He said, this is where this is going. And they didn't do much.
You can see that when you hit a good shot in the middle of the fairway and the ball's 6 inches or a foot above your
exactly.
above your own foot.
Exactly. And you really need to hit a high cut in there, but the lie says no, that's not happening.
How I'm assuming you played Augusta.
Mm-hmm.
When you stood on the 13th tee, mm-hmm. I don't know what your preferred ball flight is, but
it's going left.
You want to draw off the tee, and you want to cut it from the fairway.
That's right. That's why the hole is so genius.
There's a lot of holes like that at Augusta. The second,
there are. It's all about the angles at Augusta. People think of, they keep talking about length, speed of greens. It's all about the angles.
When you say angles, what does that mean to someone who doesn't really hasn't been a winner 17 times as a professional golfer?
Giving yourself the simplest route to the hole locations. Giving yourself more fall line shots rather than cross fall line shots. Straight up and down shots rather than having to use the elevation changes are at funky angles. It's not front left, back right. They're not a lot of the way. So if you go to Torrey Pines, they're very well defined about where the little sections of the greens are. Augusta's not like that, not as much.
So on 13 fairway, do you want to be on the right side? Is that what I'm kind of hearing?
If the hole's back left, sure.
Ah.
The hole's back right, I need to be as close to that tributary of Rays Creek as possible.
Right. What was your biggest aha moment when you teed up there for the first time?
I think the depth of the bunkers surprised me.
Height-wise?
Height-wise.
Right.
Yes. And the precision it takes to play well there. The golf course is always right on the edge that if you play great, you're going to put a great score on. And if you are just slightly off, it exposes you. And now you have 40, 50, 60-foot putts that are difficult for the very, very best players in the world.
Yeah, and any misread or miscalculation,
it looks so silly.
Yeah, your 6 or 7 footer
easily
is a hard second putt.
That's right.
Professional golfer, where do you see yourself now? What are you most? Who is Dottie? What's the most of Dottie Pepper right now? Is it speaking to a microphone, or is it professional golfer, or is it?
No, it's speaking to a microphone. It's life has moved beyond playing. I don't really play much. Partly because I'm having some physical issues with my feet, but I want to be fresh enough to do my job that I still want to come do this, not because I've been on the golf course all the time at home.
Right.
I want to continue to have a fresh look at what I look at all the time and not come at it from, this is the only thing I see is golf. Which is why McIlroy, what he's going through right now and simplifying his life and doing other things, reading movies, kind of self-look, I think is fascinating. It's great.
You must get to a point as a pro golfer that you're just sort of like a shaken soda.
Yes.
So much pressure.
So much pressure. And you have to have a release valve.
And that's canoeing.
That's canoeing. It's skiing. It's my garden. I mean, I'm looking at a 3 or 4 year plan so I can do a fundraiser in our back garden for women's and children's causes for the Sir Optimist. They do a garden tour, and I want to have my competitive side says I want to have the best garden
trophy.
Yes, no, I want to have the most people come through and say, "Holy smokes, she manages to do this when she's on the road as well."
You must have some moments where you reflect on Dottie as a professional athlete and as a mm-hmm. contender. What moment do you find yourself kind of thinking about? Is there a moment mm-hmm. that sort of said, I really enjoyed that moment, or that was meaningful to me?
I think my Solheim Cup times are some of my most fun. And I spent the 2 days of the early part of the week of Pebble in Laverne with Brandi Burton, and we had a ball. She's kind of taking some of that stuff and applying it to this girls softball team that she's coaching, and it's one of the best teams in the whole state of California. So we, just kind of put our brains to how she could get a little bit better with relating to these kids and their parents and some of the societal things that they're going through. But I think some of my favorite moments were certainly from the Solheim Cups.
That's so interesting to hear, because your resume, that's not the biggest part of your resume. It's majors, it's playoffs, it's just almost 20 wins. Mm-hmm. And then you say the thing that really meant the most to me was this sort of group victory.
Because what do we do as individual professional golfers? We're on our own.
Isolation.
We're isolation. We're all about me, and those weeks are anything but that.
I
didn't play team sports other than golf. I didn't play, which is still individual within a team. It's not like you played on the softball team, the tennis team, where you're playing literally with doubles with someone. I didn't do that. I was an individual sport kid. I skied, individual sport. So I think I really enjoyed that.
You're talking about something that kind of puts me back to, I've been thinking about what we just talked about a little bit earlier in the podcast, but process versus goal oriented. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you get to a certain point, you start focusing on goals, all of a sudden you stop enjoying the process.
Right.
I'm curious to know, was that part of what made the Solheim Cup experiences so meaningful to you, is that it was so unusual that it was every other year, and it was, the process was something exciting?
Well, there was a process to getting on the team.
Of course.
And then you have to break down that process to not only how do I get on the team, how do I play well enough to make the points to get on the team? How do I prepare myself to play well enough to get those points? But I loved seeing what happened behind the scenes. Being able to stay with Judy Rankin in the house at Muirfield Village and see what she went through as a captain and all the other things that went along with it. It wasn't just putting a lineup out there. It was dealing with media. It was dealing with sponsors. It was making sure we had clean shirts because it had been hot all week long and we ran out of regular golf shirts. So we had to do laundry on Sunday night, and she and I stayed up and pressed shirts that night, or Saturday night. Those are the things that kind of, I liked the behind the scenes of the television. I liked the behind the scenes of putting tournaments together. I liked the behind the scenes of what you do as a player to get ready to play well.
I think, you know, when I look at what you've kind of spent your life working on, I think to me one of the most interesting things is kind of this unfortunate problem that we're faced with in 2020, which is that golf in general has some problems, however you want to look at it. But even further to that, women's golf, whatever tour it is, whether it's junior golf, whether it's, watching golf on television, I'm curious to know, you know, we all know kind of the issues associated with it, that it's a minority within a niche, right?
Yep.
Where do we, is there a direction? What can I do? What can the people listening to this in their car or lawnmower or headphones do?
I think, well, let's put it this. This is the 75th anniversary of the United States Women's Open. And I had a sit down this week with Fox for their USGA look at all of this. And the thing that stood out to me was, even going back to Babe Zaharias in 54 and when Mickey Wright won at San Diego Country Club, they're athletes and they could just flat play. And that, and people embraced that. They were out there. There were a lot of people out there watching that golf. Even when Carner beat Palmer at Rolling Hills, like 76, I think, outside Philadelphia, there were a lot of people out there watching two really good athletes just go at it. And I think we forget that part. That they're really good athletes, and they also they're not that strong that they can get away with some of the things that the guys can do, because they can overpower a golf course, overpower a golf ball. So look at it as great athletes, but also an opportunity to learn how to get better at what we're all trying to do. Because I think you have to work really hard not to go to a golf tournament, an LPGA golf tournament, and learn something.
Right.
About the way they get it around, the way their mechanics and their fundamentals are so good. There's no room for error. And I think if people understand that and just take a look at, these women can actually make me better.
I found that watching swings on the LPGA or the LET way more beneficial to my tempo and my game.
Swing speed, compression, all of it. Yes.
When I watch, the worst thing I can do before playing golf is watch one frame, one sort of swing video from Brooks Koepka. That's the worst thing I could do.
Absolutely.
I will lose every tee ball.
McIlroy, same thing.
Yeah. That is.
No.
It's not relatable.
Right.
But it's also, it's just not good to look at and then go play.
Right. That's the imprint in your brain. It's not going to work.
I'm hurting my back thinking about
yes.
it. When you think about women's golf, though, have we come a long way?
I think we've definitely come a long way. There are still more challenges to make.
Like what?
Purses.
Hmm.
Come up, give me a better business plan, because it really is a business plan. Eyeballs justify what you're paying people. So how do I get more eyeballs there? How do I, it's not a sympathy thing. If I'm sitting on a board, I'm not just going to say, well, we're going to throw $2 million toward women's golf because it's the right thing to do. No, I need to have the reason to do that. So give me more interaction with the players. Give me the reason that they're going to drive more to my company's charity, that they're going to drive more to a particular cause. So come up with a robust business plan that I can justify as a board from a publicly traded company or privately traded company to put money into women's golf.
It's interesting. You know, I was in Korea in October, and women's golf is largely the majority of what's watched and you know, tee times booked.
Correct.
I don't understand.
Golf's cool.
Right.
And one word, one name, Sayri Park. And they ran with it. They absolutely ran with it. It was the can-do kid. And 22 years later, still the can-do kid.
Why didn't Lexi have that effect on the United States? Or did she?
I think she did in pockets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to go.
You have to continue to win.
Right.
What did Sayri Park do? She continued to win. What has NB Park continued to do?
Today.
Today, exactly. Continues to win. You can't have a Paula Creamer that won one major championship. You can't have Lexi just show up. You have to. There has to be sustainable face.
It's
sustainable output.
It seems like whether you're whatever golf tournament you're watching or tour or anything, it seems like we as fans just want someone that we can get behind that will probably win. You know, it's like we yeah. want to root for someone that we think will have a chance to win.
And it's our job as broadcasters to give you a reason to root for them.
How do you do that?
We need to personalize them, tell you stuff that you wouldn't otherwise be able to know.
Right.
Always.
So what are you going to say the about Rory today that I don't know? This will air much after wow. this tournament, so it's all
I learned something from talking to him yesterday. So I, watching him hit balls on the range, he's got his watch on his right hand.
I noticed that too.
Typically, you wear your timepiece on the hand that you don't write with, correct?
Yeah.
So I said, you're not left-handed, are you? And he said, no. He said, but I'm so used to having, it was that band, the monitoring band.
I'm wearing it right now.
He said, I was so used to having that on my wrist that it was just fine to put my watch there. And they made the stem collapsible so it doesn't get in the way.
Oh, yeah, because when he takes his right hand to the top.
That's right. The stem would be.
Yeah, the crown would hit the back of his hand.
Correct. So it collapses. But that piece is still on him.
On his leg. Bicep?
Left bicep.
Left bicep. Why did he hide it?
He said it's just where it felt comfortable.
Yeah, because it's kind of a tight fit.
Yeah, so it's on his left bicep.
We're talking about the Whoop strap, everybody. Yeah. I got mine 3 days ago.
Yeah.
But this is not an ad for
so
that.
So it's on his left bicep, but like son of a gun.
Interesting. No one would know that.
No one would know that. And that he switched to metal spikes again.
Really?
Yes.
When was that?
Beginning of this year.
Why?
He feels comfortable enough. Well, left ankle.
Right.
All is good.
He can put the stress on it.
He can put the stress on it. And I do think if you get on uneven ground and there's any moisture at all, it's another just level of contact with the ground, and where is he generating his power? From the ground up.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
That's go zone.
It really is.
Yes.
Oh, I'm excited to watch today. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, no. So as I said on the air yesterday, he's no longer going to sneak up on you because you can hear him coming.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me. It's been a really pleasant talk. Thank you.